The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Philip Cunliffe is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at the University of Kent. His book, Lenin Lives, was published in September by Zero Books. It's Wednesday, November 15th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that we've moved the Inside Zero Books podcast from the Zero Books blog to Patreon. This will make it easier to get the members-only podcast on podcatchers. And if you're a former member who emailed your address to take me up on the Zero Books parting gift of a random paperback, that should be on its way. You might also get a hold of Philip Cunliffe's Lenin Lives. And of course, if you haven't read it already, get yourself a copy of Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. The music you're listening to right now is an instrumental version of the 1894 hit, I Don't Want to Play in Your Yard. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Philip Cunliffe and I discuss Brexit and Lenin. Philip Cunliffe is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at the University of Kent. He appears frequently on radio and writes widely on politics, contributing to academic journals, reviews, business intelligence services, magazines, and a variety of political blogs. He is also the author of the book Lenin Lives, which is out now from Zero Books. So, Philip, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
To what extent is your book an alternative history of the Soviet Union that asks the question, what if Lenin had lived?
It's a counterfactual history, and one that plays on one of the title and the hook, I guess, for the book, play on one of these common questions, I suppose, that left-wing people ask themselves, which is, what if one of them is, what if Trotsky had succeeded in defeating Stalin in the battle for power after Lenin's death? And another one is, if Lenin had lived a bit longer, in better health perhaps, in order to thwart Stalin's rise to power, that perhaps things would have turned out differently in the Soviet Union. And that's one of the common what-ifs, I suppose, of looking back at Soviet history and left-wing people looking back at the history of the 20th century. So it keys into that, I guess, but pivots away from it and rather is thinking about Lenin in terms of him as a successful revolutionary. So I guess the spirit of Lenin more than Lenin himself living. So it's not actually about an alternative history of the Soviet Union, but an alternative history of the 20th century as a whole.
You write about the dialectics of revolution and counter-revolution in your book, the significance of communism in modernity as something that actually, in a variety of ways, supports capitalist enterprises, capitalist expansion. Can you explain your concept of the dialectics of revolution?
It's a big question. I was trying to put across the idea that capitalism as a contradictory social system in the classical Marxist vein, develops the possibility and the foundation for a new and superior form of society. So it lays the foundations of progress into a different kind of society. So the effort to suppress communism, to use that word for the superior form of society, which is being developed within capitalism. If you suppress that, you end up suppressing the most progressive aspects of capitalism. You end up suppressing what's best about it, and thereby it collapses back into itself, progresses and fragments, or at least that's the story that I tell in the book. And that's cast in somewhat abstract language, but I suppose the point is that the point that I really want to drive home, or I try to drive home in the book at least, is that the suppression of communism ended up suppressing the course of historical development, the possibility of progress, and in the end ended up suppressing capitalism itself. And that, I suppose, is the abstract answer to the question.
Yeah, you gave a concrete example, if I'm remembering correctly, about the space race and how it was necessary to have the Soviet adversary for Americans to get into space and get to the moon. Is that a good example of what you mean by communism being necessary for the best aspects of capitalist development to be brought to the fore?
That's the opposite. So when I talk about, there is this saying, you know, there's this kind of offhand saying about how the Apollo moon landings were the greatest success of Soviet communism. Just the idea that the Soviet competition with the Soviet Union spurred American capitalism to go further than it otherwise would have. And I don't wish, I mean, in the book, I don't, and the argument in the book isn't to suggest that communism is a alternative system which might be, you know, have better healthcare or might be more egalitarian or might provide better public education, and that it's possible to kind of choose between the two, and that the two systems might be in some kind of geopolitical, long-term geopolitical contest in the way that they were in the Cold War. It's more, what I was trying to do instead is to suggest that communism isn't, it's not an alternative to capitalism, it's the next stage, or it should be the next stage at least, or would have been the next stage of human development. So something which was superior to capitalism. And so an example which isn't developed in the book, because it is in fact our history, the history of the 20th century, is more to the what we have actually had. So the intense expansion of the state, intensely kind of controlled and regulated state management of capitalism, the intense politicization of the economy, politicization of labor and control of labor, and at least in the old corporatist state, the integration of the challenge that labor organizations pose, being integrated into the state. So we've inherited a very variegated, I guess, and complex social system, which is marked by the defeat of the working class, and the defeat of organized labor, and the defeat of the party of movement, the defeat of the left, is built in to the way in which contemporary capitalism functions.
Yeah, what you're saying is very interesting to me. I kind of have a knee-jerk reaction against it, because I feel like there's a marked break between capitalism and socialism or communism, that what defines capitalism is capital and a certain mode of production and relationship to the markets, and that a communist society just wouldn't have that same engine of production, and that it would be some sort of event, to use, I don't know, kind of a buzzword from the moment, in order to get to a socialist or communist society. But you seem to be saying that there's a continuity between capitalism and communism, that there is maybe an easier progression that we've avoided politically, but that we could have not avoided, and that we would have developed through capitalism in a kind of continuous way to communism. Or am I misunderstanding?
No, I mean, I think that's accurate, at least to some degree. I suppose, though, rather than communism being so proximate and close, but rather socialism, and that very kind of effectively overdue, I suppose. even, and that the it's something which is the failure to achieve it is evident, I think, in the course of the 20th century, and in even perhaps in the way in which our social, the way in which our societies function at the moment. So that, I think, social system which would not be so dramatically different from the one that we're familiar with. But communism, I think, would be, the case that I make in the book is it's not really, properly speaking, it's not really a society at all. And so that it's something which would look extremely different and would be a, it would be a kind of, the way I put it in the book, at least, is that humanity emerges from society, and that's the meaning of communism, that society falls away because it's no longer society, which is to say organized infrastructure of social control, the state, division of labor associated with differentiated access to the means of production. All of these things that we associate with society, those things, I think, would fall away in communism. So I don't want to say communist society because I think it's actually a contradiction in terms. And it's an idea which I kind of experimented a bit with in the book. So I think, anyway, to answer your question, to get back to your question, communism, I think, is a distant form of human association. And however, socialism, I think, is more proximate. And in the classical tradition, it was the stepping stone to the future form of humanity. And that, I think, is, yeah, that I don't think that would be necessarily vastly different, though it would be, like you say, I mean, it wouldn't be based on private property and a mode of production that would look different. But in many other respects, I think it wouldn't be alien to us or very unfamiliar, I think, to what we expect from high-tech, industrialized, modern societies.
I'm interested in the inclusion of the word infrastructure in what wouldn't be present in a communist society. And so when I think of infrastructure, I think of physical, you know, objects, buildings, roads, libraries, you know, homes.
Sure.
And that kind of infrastructure would continue to exist in a communist world. Unless you're thinking that we're all going to live inside the Matrix or something.
No. It was perhaps probably a poorly chosen turn of phrase. By infrastructure, I guess I don't mean physical infrastructure of modernity, or, you know, good stuff, roads and electricity pylons and all the rest of it, and the internet. I mean that society as a form of as a social structure, with its constraints and with its patterns and routine patterns of behavior, with infrastructure in the sense of bureaucracy, in the sense of state control, in the sense of state agencies, in the sense of state security. I mean, by that, I mean the kind of abstract term for capturing the various things that we associate with society. And I think that in the same way that communism, in the classical idea, you know, communism didn't have a state, I think it would also be meaningful to say it's not really a society. It's a form of human association that that makes the normal kind of the need for regulation and the need for external control, or the need, or that has conflict over, in which there is conflict over resources, and in which humanity is divided between divided into classes. And struggles and is internally divided over the means of production. That is what I understand by society. And I think that if communism were established, that would be the thing it would put an end to. So to that degree, it would put an end to society.
Well, listen, I don't mean to be silly here, but I'm going to tell you a little anecdote. When I was in my 20s, so a long time ago now, I used to be involved with some socialist organizations, sort of a fellow traveler, and I recall going to a Labor Party meeting and having a conversation on the way there with a dyed-in-the-wool socialist action activist that just drove him crazy. I mean, he just thought I was the silliest person in the world. And somehow this sticks out in my mind and comes to mind right now. I said to him, you know what we'll need to develop if we're truly going to have a communist society is telepathy and empathy, telepathic empathy, so that we are always connected to one another. There's no mediation. Our wills will be as one. And he just looked at me like I was what I was, which is a hippie science fiction writer. And so, but that's what comes to mind again when you talk about a world in which there wouldn't be divisions between people. It seems very fantastical. Do you think, I mean, I'm probably misreading this. So could you address the concerns that this communist society is utopian in a almost a religious way?
Whether it would be a big, like, single, spontaneously functioning hive mind or...
Yeah, right.
Can you help us? Our planet was taken over by some kind of entity. It absorbed the minds of our people.
We didn't notice it until it was too late. The people it takes over, they look like your friends, your family, your leaders, but they're not themselves anymore. They're part of it.
Then how do you know it didn't get on the ship with you? Those two ding-dongs seem pretty calm about the whole thing.
Hey, yo! No, we
can't! Hold it.
The claim I make in the book is that, you know, for most of human history, that which is to say, since we've been humans, since we stopped swinging from the trees, society didn't exist. In the sense of human beings associated, obviously, like in we associated in small communities, bands of hunter gatherers, what have you, and that's humanity. That was what humanity was. There is no society in the sense of elaborated, articulated division of labor or stratified groups and hierarchies with priests and generals and bureaucrats and centralized forms of authority. That comes later, say, over the last 10,000 years. And that is, what humanity – so humanity has been trapped in society effectively for the last 10,000 years, which isn't all of human history. So I suppose the claim is that – the way I understand it, at least, that communism is the return to humanity, but obviously not in the primitive form of the kind of eco-anarchist or neo-primitivist version of returning to pre-civilization, but rather humanity is restored. Those aspects of society fall away. Humanity is restored on a higher level with technology. With much kind of greater levels of technology and control, but I mean not in the sense of abolishing individuals or that it would be utopia in the sense of a perfected system in which there's nothing meaningful or nothing left to struggle for, or that there is a kind of life that is purged of challenges and fear. I wouldn't understand it like that. And I don't think it was understood by that in the classical Marxist tradition either.
So how do you come to write Lenin Lives? And I mean, I guess I'm asking you sort of what's your history around radical politics too?
So I don't have much history around radical politics at all. And I kind of, flirted with or been on the edges of certain kinds of far left or former far left groups in the UK. But I mean nothing, in particular. So I can't really claim any great experience or insight into organized radical politics, at least. The inspiration and, many of my conversations with people who are on the far left end up, I imagine them looking at me. I think I've seen the face that you describe of this person you spoke to those years ago. Like, I think I know exactly the expression. And many of them look at me in the same way all the time. I'm sympathetic. Around the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War in 2014, I read a counterfactual account of the outbreak of the First World War. What if Archduke Franz Ferdinand hadn't been killed and the First World War never happened, and what would the world look like, among the other things I was reading. And so that got me thinking about I was already flinching in anticipation of the centenary of 2017, because I expected there would be, you know, a wave of calumny and slander and ordure and moralism about the failure of the Russian Revolution, and using it as an opportunity to instill moral fables about the, you know, the failure of any attempt to change the world for the better. So I was thinking about this in advance, and I was thinking about how can I, how can I prepare to do something, to say something, and this, the counterfactual in response to World War One, and thinking about the oncoming centenary of the Russian Revolution, put the two ideas into my head. To, you know, any leftist who claims to be one has thought about what would have what might the world have looked like if things had turned out for the better. And I thought, why not pursue that thought? Why not engage in the wish fulfillment and see where we end up?
What have you thought of the response to the anniversary of the Russian Revolution? Have you gotten the reactions? Have there been the kind of media spectacle and denunciations of the whole project that you anticipated?
No. I mean, it's been strange, and I'm certainly not the only one to remark upon this or to notice it. It's been, it's almost like nobody knows what to say. And I find that really strange. So, I mean, there has been some reflection, but I think, I mean, I'm just, this is an impression. I've not counted them. But I think in terms of the number of books that had come out on the centenary of 1914, already well before the actual outbreak of the war itself, and the number of books and the degree of, the newspaper supplements, the articles, the essays, the review essays, the reviews of books, the authors, the interviews, the radio interviews, TV shows, documentaries, it just seemed to me to be overwhelming by comparison to the lackluster, ambivalent, and fairly muted response that we've had to the Russian Revolution. And that, I think, is across the political spectrum to the centenary of the revolution. And it's still slightly puzzling to me. I mean, I don't know how you see it. It's puzzling to me. I think is that nobody really knows what to say. And I think on the right, at least, or from the powers that be, I think there's no, there's no way in which they can use the Russian Revolution to vindicate capitalism. And I think perhaps that's why there is just no great appetite for talking about it, in the sense that, you know, I mean, it's failed. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. There's no challenger to capitalism, even though capitalism is in crisis. So, you know, there's no political benefit to talking about it in any great detail. It's just, it almost belongs to a different era, or almost to a parallel, you know, to a parallel dimension or something. It just doesn't belong to this world in a way. So there's nothing to be gained from talking about it. So it's more embarrassing, I think, for the left, because the left seems to be equally ambivalent or hesitant, or just wishes that it would go away. So I noticed on social media, for instance, the, you know, kind of leading luminaries of the left of today seem to be extremely, either they totally ignored it, as far as I could tell, or they kind of cursorily dismissed it, moved on. And now I thought it was all very strange and peculiar.
I wonder if it has something to do with the feeling that we're in a far right moment, or that we're facing a threat from the far right, and that there's little room for fantasies of radical change anymore on the left.
The sense of imminent doom is very strong here. Among liberals, the liberal center extending to the left, mainly because of Brexit. So there is this deep feeling of doom and even imminent catastrophe, to the point of people openly, you know, people even openly speculate about the need to overturn, almost, you know, not quite, but almost to the point of wishing a coup to halt Brexit. So, there is that sense of almost imminent apocalypse here as well, I think. And, I think misguided, you know, deeply misguided, but that's another story. So as far as it explains the unwillingness to, I'm not sure. I mean, I think perhaps, you know, if people felt like they could point to something in the past that offered an alternative, they would do. if only to kind of rally. So I think clearly they don't feel, they clearly don't feel that they're connected, that they're meaningfully connected or can draw on anything really from the Russian Revolution to point to today. It's still mysterious to me, I think, but I think it seems to me at least that the left, in so much as they exist, kind of left intellectuals or far left organizations, perhaps even, but particularly the left intellectuals, they seem embarrassed by the revolution, or at least unwilling to say anything about it.
What would you point to as what we should be looking at to be inspired by history and by the revolution?
I could speak to things that I think personally are inspiring about it. Would be the alternative political institutions that were spontaneously developed throughout the course of 1917 in Russia. So the Soviets, famously, which fused executive and legislative functions and offered an alternative, a practical kind of working alternative that was devised by soldiers and workers in the cities, in Petrograd at the time, in Moscow, in order to administer, in order to run society, in contrast to the liberal kind of parliamentary regime that was the other pole of political power. So I think that's inspiring, the creation of new political institutions that break with the functioning and structures of liberal democracy, that are more democratic, in fact, than those of liberal democracy. I think that's inspiring. I think the awareness on the part of Russian workers and the popular support for the Bolsheviks in realizing that to end the war, they had to overthrow the provisional government. They had to overthrow the liberal, the kind of liberal government that had supplanted the Tsar after the February Revolution. So they knew that even though they had been, they'd overthrown a 300-year-old dynasty, and they'd established a new liberal regime under a popular leader, Kerensky, that nonetheless, they realized that the war continued and that they needed another, that the level of popular consciousness and understanding was so great that they realized another revolution was needed in order to halt Russia's participation in a murderous world war. So I think that's inspiring. And then also I think the international dimensions of people's calculations, in particular, obviously on the left, which is the calculations I key into for the book, that they, Lenin and the Bolsheviks, calculated around a wider revolution. So not just overthrowing a government within a state, but hoping for solidarity that was international, hoping for international revolution.
Yes, and that last bit is, I think, very far away from most people's imaginations today.
Yeah, absolutely.
It seems like nationalism is fully accepted on both the left and the right at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I think, is in fact the strength of that, and the strength of the nation as the kind of container for any kind of political vision or project, I think, is an artifact of the defeat of the left and the narrowing of its horizons over the last century.
For Marx, it all starts with the fact that capitalist production is production for market exchange. This basic form of production takes on law-like properties that he calls the law of value.
I wanted to bring up something from a different book to you. It's one you haven't read, so it's a little unfair, but I assume you haven't read it yet. It's Anselm Zsäpe's book, The Writing on the Wall, which we published around the same time that we published Lenin Lives. And it has an interesting premise, is that we need to accept that there is no political solution to capitalism, or to be clear, that seizing the state and reorganizing or reimagining administrative power won't go far enough to bring us out of a capitalist system of production. and capitalist markets as well, and that we really need to reimagine what production will be like and what our economic basis for a future society, whether it's socialist or communist, needs to be. And I feel like this is something that you would reject, but I just want to get a reaction from you for the little bit I said about Shape's book.
I'm very excited to read it. And I'm not just saying that.
Okay.
It's on my wish list, and I was very intrigued when I read about it. I mean, I'm certainly open to the argument, because I think it would be foolish to, given the context that we're in, it would be foolish to ignore any kind of, to ignore or dismiss, at least, sincere efforts to think about how we might develop something better. I am skeptical. I'd venture, obviously without having read it, but I'd venture perhaps in the opposite direction and say that I think probably that it's perhaps more than ever, it's, it is more a political task than ever before, I think, given the sheer kind of scale of the integration of the global economy, its tremendous sophistication, its incredibly technologically rich and developed levels of automation and sophistication, and all of this makes me think that it's all there. I mean, I think it's already, production is so deeply socialized, so deeply interconnected, so deeply automated, that really it is about a conscious, which is to say political, reorganization of how we manage our affairs more than it would be developing a new economic system. It seems to me that economic system is there, and it's simply a matter of politically resolving the problems of our society rather than trying to develop a whole new system.
What do you think about the idea of a negative blueprint for socialism or communism, one based on what we know we have to get rid of if we are to escape capitalist exploitation? So, we want to get rid of a process where labor is exploited for profit. And, we think deeply about how that works based on, say, reading Capital. And we come up with not a blueprint, a positive blueprint, but at least a list of, or a schema for what we'd have to abandon in order to have socialism, or probably more so communism.
Oh, do I have an idea of a negative blueprint, you mean? I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think it's more the way I see it is I think it's an artifact or a hangover of the Cold War, that we tend to think of capitalism and socialism as kind of choices that are parallel to some degree, or that we, as if we could kind of choose one set of policies over another down to preference. And I would guess I'd like to get away from that. And I think socialism is better seen as it's the resolution of the contradictions of capitalism.
Politically, and that would be, and you politically resolve those kind of.
I think you can. Well, the political resolution leads to the economic resolution, I think. So political, the abolition of private property under a socialist state. And a socialist state, which would look different from our liberal democratic states, that I think would be socialism. I don't think it's not even a negative blueprint. I think it's like I say, simply using political power to resolve the contradictions of the current social system.
Okay, well, let me just add. You said something earlier that I have to ask you about. What is your opinion of Brexit? Because you said that the left is looking, in the UK, is looking at Brexit with a real fear and loathing, and you think that that's misguided. What's your opinion of Brexit?
I'm one of the few openly pro-Brexit academics in the UK. You can probably count them on the fingers of two hands, at least those who are public about it. So it's been interesting. Let's put it that way. It's the single most important political event of my adult life. as a conscious, you know, as a conscious citizen. And it was a tremendous experience to both to witness the aftermath of it, but also to see that people were that people still had sufficient wherewithal in the ballot box to resist the kind of promises of instant economic ruination and apocalypse which were being promoted by the elite at the time of the referendum. So it's something which I think is the restoration of popular sovereignty and the restoration of parliamentary sovereignty as against the membership of the European Union, I think, is a positive. Anything which I think gives people greater control over their lives, at least even potentially, I think is a good thing. And I think Brexit has the potential to deliver that. And certainly breaking free from the European Union, which is based on thwarting, I think, popular sovereignty, I think is a good thing.
Yeah. So from your perspective, what's important is even if it's just a baby step towards rebuilding a political project for socialism, it is a baby step in that direction because it wrests controls away from the European Union elites and puts control over the national fate back into the hands of the people.
Yeah, and I would go even further. I mean, I'd say that even if it isn't a baby step towards socialism, it's still a tremendous positive, simply by virtue of the fact of giving the possibility of restoring democracy, of giving people more political control over their lives, of disciplining our political elites through the exercise of popular will, imposing will of the majority onto elites in a very clear expression. There was a very clear political choice, a meaningful political choice as well, you know, not just kind of choosing between two parties that are very similar policies, but I think a genuine political choice. And people felt it. Everything, I mean, it was astonishing. I mean, I don't want to overplay it, but like I had more, you know, normally when I talk to people and they ask me what I do and I say like, oh, I'm a politics lecturer, you know, they just kind of obviously they've got no interest in talking further. But during the referendum, in the run up to the referendum, after the referendum, everybody wanted to talk politics, like, you know, kind of an ordinary everyday interaction. I heard more, kind of overheard more political conversations on public transport, you know, eating out, drinking, all of these things. So there was, I think, the kind of, we can already see the benefits of Brexit. I think Jeremy Corbyn's, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn now has ideological distance between him and the Tory government means that there is more meaningful political choice for the electorate than there was before, and that's an effect of Brexit. I think there's greater politicization among ordinary people, and that's an effect of Brexit. And all of those things are good things, I think. And like I say, I would value them even if I didn't think that there was any hope of getting us closer to socialism as a result. So I think there are two main objections. I think one of them is that it's a expression of xenophobia and nationalism, and therefore is kind of the idea of Brexit is incorrigibly corrupted and hostage to those you know, expressions of narrow chauvinism. And the other is that the European Union, you know, is kind of for the bosses, but so is the national state. Therefore, there's no meaningful difference in choosing between the two. It's a false choice. I mean, and obviously, you know, I don't find either of those objections meaningful or convincing, but those are basically the two objections to a pro-Brexit position from the left, at least.
Well, putting aside the charges of xenophobia, I mean, I think that there's just no denying that certain political players in the UK used xenophobia and racism to champion Brexit. I mean, that doesn't mean everyone did, but that was certainly an element of the pro-Brexit side. But putting that aside, my objection would be that the global economy will punish the UK and limit what the people in the UK can do after Brexit, that you're going to see economic consequences of Brexit, which limit people's autonomy and power and push the UK out of being a significant force in the world as it is. So you're going to see suffering for the working classes in the UK after Brexit, even though staying in the EU is hardly some dream. What do you say to that objection?
So I don't. The xenophobia thing, I think, is, you know, like there was, I mean, there was, but I don't think it's defining of the pro-Brexit vote.
Yeah.
But, you know, in directly answering your question. So I think people who voted Brexit and from what I've read and kind of encountered and talked about with people appreciate that there will be an economic cost, but that it's one that they're willing to countenance insofar as they think that it's worth it for the degree of the greater political control that they envisage, or the greater control over their own society that they envisage as a result of Brexit. So will there be economic disruption? I think there will. I think to imagine that Britain's economic problems are the result, you know, either positively or negatively, of being in the European Union, I think would be to misdiagnose them. There are genuine economic problems in Britain, stagnant wages and low productivity, which has been, it's constantly shared on social media and in discussion as to that it's some of the worst among the rich economies in terms of low productivity and low wages, and just how slow and bad our recovery has been. And that's nothing, you know, those things, they need to be tackled in the UK. I don't think our integration with the European Union is either here or there with respect to that. So, yeah, I mean, that would be my response, I guess. I think, you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of working class voters, obviously not. But I think it would be fair to say that given the fact that the opinion polls haven't really moved, as there's no evidence in the opinion polls of regret over Brexit, I think people are willing to countenance some economic dislocation in order to see it through.
Well, I know that I get paid in pounds for working for Zero Books, and I quite like that because the pound is worth more than the dollar. I'm hoping that.
So I guess you don't like Brexit much then.
No, I don't. It's going to mean the pound is going to be devalued against the dollar.
Yeah.
But that's a perhaps not the broadest view. Okay, so back to Lenin. I'm just going to ask you this question. What if Lenin had lived?
I'm happy to give the spoiler alert because it's not the main part of the story, I guess, in the book. Is that so? In the book, what happened in reality is he his health was shattered by overwork and by assassins' bullets, and he failed to really marshal any kind of significant or lasting opposition to the growth of Stalin's influence in the revolutionary state. In the book, he lives a bit. So in the counterfactual history I portray, he lives a bit longer. And his health is less kind of severely affected because of the success of the revolution spreading to the West. But he still ends up being, two things. So he ends up being far less significant because the revolutions in the West overtake and surpass those of Russia. So part of the paradox of Lenin Lives is had Lenin been more politically successful, he would have also ended up being a much less historically significant persona. So that's one kind of claim. But also he ends up fighting for in continuity with his political biography, he ends up defending classic liberal politics, defending the rights of nations to self-determination. The premise being that if the revolution had succeeded in spreading to the West, it would have resulted in a socialist Europe that was more German, given the strength of German socialism at the time. And the Germans, among German Marxists, they looked down, they were less respectful of self-determination than Lenin was. So in the counterfactual story of the book, at least, Lenin ends up fighting a rearguard action to preserve the rights of nations, of minority nations to secede, their rights to self-determination against a more haughty, I guess, vision of German Marxism.